P.S. I Love Hoffman is brought to you by the Cage Club Podcast Network. For all things Cage Club related, head on over to cageclub.me. That's cageclub.me.
So, Kyle, we have another Philadelphia film. We originally had Money for Nothing. That was
yay!
Was that the only Philadelphia film we've ever had of Hoffman's?
Philadelphia. You know what, Brian? To the best of my knowledge, well, okay, he was in, part of it took place in Philadelphia in The Master. I know that.
Oh, true, yeah.
Let me quick look at his IMDb here, and definitely not Capote.
I don't think there's other Philadelphia films.
Oh, well, the Oakland A's play in Philadelphia, right?
In the movie at some point? I don't think so.
No, I'm just it was a bad joke of saying like the city of the team and that they play. Ides of March, he's from Pennsylvania, the governor, but that's not there.
No.
Yeah, to the best of my knowledge, I'll keep. But go ahead.
I was just thinking, like, what are your favorite Philadelphia films, or what are some iconic Philadelphia films? I don't know about this.
Yeah,
one,
obviously, Rocky. Yeah.
Yes, like, many of the Rockies.
That's still, after winning the Super Bowl, that's still their, like, best-known athlete, Rocky Balboa.
Well, I mean, not all the Rockies are Philadelphia films. Definitely one, two, three, yeah, more of a Los Angeles film.
But yeah. Well, it's just because Los Angeles is such, like, a cool thing in the movie.
It does take place somewhat in Philadelphia, but it's not, I wouldn't say, like, a real good Philly film.
No, it's not a Philly movie.
Four, certainly not. Five, yes. 100%.
Yes.
And Creed. Yeah. And Creed, 100%.
Yeah, so it's pretty much, like, kind of not three, definitely not four, the rest, yes.
Philadelphia, the Tom Hanks, Denzel Washington film.
Yes.
Good Philadelphia film.
I would say that's a very Philadelphia movie.
We're definitely missing some really, like, Invincible, the Vince Papale story.
Again, that's, you know, even it's about Vince Papale, but for some reason Rocky Balboa is still the most known athlete.
Silver Linings Playbook.
Ugh.
I'm thinking of all these Eagle films, and I guess we're kind of dancing around this whole congratulating them for winning the Super Bowl.
Well, I'm not going to congratulate them.
What? They had a fair effort. They beat the Patriots, the mighty Patriots.
They beat old geriatric Tom Brady. The Giants beat 30 and 34 year old Tom Brady. They beat 40 year old Tom Brady.
Still not going to give the Eagles the credit, huh?
Nope.
Iggy Pop! Amen! Let it ride!
I'm a fucking idiot.
Red meat, we crave sustenance.
I'm an artist.
Hello, my name is Truman Capote.
It's fun to have some fun.
Fun.
Tommy.
That's a paycheck.
Whoever she is, I'm going to find her and I'm going to hurt her.
I've spent the past 3 years learning Spanish.
I'm always home. I'm uncool.
This is a process of dehypnotization.
Shut up.
Hey, Hoff fans. Welcome to this week's edition of the P.S. I Love Hoffman podcast, our love letter to the remarkable career of the late, great Philip Seymour Hoffman. I'm Brian Rodriguez.
And I'm Kyle Reinfried.
We're always home, we're always uncool, we're always ready to talk great movies. Kyle, it's always a special day on this podcast, but I feel like this is an...
This is special, special. This
an
is double
extra special.
Special
day. Yes, because we have two of our favorite guests on. Michael Manzi.
Yes, two of our favorite guests, but they are the co-creators. Oh. They are the guys that started it. It was their brainchild. This is the first time we're having both of you on at the same time. This is awesome. So, yes, I'm sorry for cutting
you off,
no,
Brian. Wait,
no, that's not.
This is the second time.
Kyle, where have you been?
Both of you on at the same... Both of them on at the same time?
Yes.
Yeah. Haven't you been studying your statistics?
And both times that we've been on, we've started a film with Philip Seymour Hoffman having sex with a woman way out of his league.
Yes. Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. And it had a cold open...
I forgot about
also.
That.
And they're both movies where robberies go wrong.
Yeah, and except in this one, the old lady kicks ass instead of
hell
gets
yeah
shot to death.
One of the only people I like in this movie.
I was thinking about that. I'm like, what are the odds that the two of you are on for a movie that's not, I don't want to say so similar, but like so many similar plot points, including opening or almost opening with awkward Philip Seymour Hoffman sex.
Yeah, and also kind of both episodes we sort of botched our intros. So like, are
you consistent? Have you seen my name yet? Have you introduced me?
No, I said Michael Manzi. I was about to say your name. Joey Lewandowski, I believe, the godfather himself.
Jesus Christ.
And now Kyle,
canceled.
And Kyle, do you remember the episode that the two of them were on?
Nope.
Oh, man, with all those clues, you don't remember what movie that was?
Better Off Dead.
That's not even a... We didn't even record that for this show.
Before the Devil Knows You're Dead?
Before yes. The Devil Knows You're Dead, correct. See, and interesting, both titles have God's Pocket, Before the Devil Knows You're Dead.
They're like opposite movies, yeah.
And they're both bad.
I like the other one more,
I'll just say that.
I think we're going to have more consensus on this one. I could be wrong, but the film, as we've alluded to, is God's Pocket, one of Philip Seymour Hoffman's last films. It's debatable what his like last living film was. Apparently this was the last film that he completed before his death, but not necessarily. Well, obviously not released, because we have the two Hunger Games, but the film we have next week technically had a wide release, though they both premiered at Sundance. Point is, this is in the last act of his career. God's Pocket.
I want to apologize to Mike up front, because when you guys came to us and said, we want to have you both on for one more episode before we're done, and you gave us a list of episodes that were left, and I was like, oh, I saw this in theaters, I like this movie, let's do this movie. And then I watched it, and I was like, what was I thinking? Terrible, but it's not good. And the movie's...
It's a first-time director.
The movie's biggest offense is killing off Caleb Landry Jones three times. Like, he is the only one with life in this movie. And you're like, hey, let's just keep killing the guy. Like, the movie opens with him at his funeral, and then we bring him back to life, and then we kill him, and then he, quote-unquote, dies again in an accident at the end. And after completing 2017, which was the year of Caleb Landry Jones, Twin Peaks, Get Out, Florida Project, Three Billboards, American Made, lots of good roles there. He dies three times in this movie, and I'm like, come on. Like, everybody else is sleepwalking through this movie, and Caleb Landry Jones, even though he's like a racist asshole in this, is like, at least he's like, hey, I'm, you know, saying things, doing things, dancing around, spinning knives around. Like, he's got life here, and everybody else is like, oh, we're Philadelphia workers.
Oh, come on. John Turturro, Richard Jenkins, Philip Seymour Hoffman.
I do like
these
Richard
guys
Jenkins,
are,
but I don't know.
We're back in Philly.
I was going to say Michael Manzi. You were on another.
Guys. My first episode was Money for Nothing.
There you go.
Cusack.
Welcome back, a working man Philly.
I love Caleb as a performer. Like, he is an amazing act. Like, he's just so, like, such an interesting guy to watch and listen to. And, I mean, did you mention X-Men First Class? Because
I only mentioned the things that were last year. Like, he good things last year. Like, he's been great forever. And there was, one of my favorite tweets that I've ever seen says he does more with the whites of his eyes than most actors do with their entire body.
Yeah, he just has he's just so weird in that X-Men movie. It's like, I watch it again just to watch his performance, because he feels like a mutant in that as a person, like as an actor and stuff. But I actually think I think most of the performances in this movie are pretty strong. Like, it's a performance film. It's not necessarily I don't feel like the story is the main object here. I think it's more about the acting and everything. But yeah, it's a very unfortunate that he is gone early. Like, my main complaint about most movies is stuff happens too late in films, and I definitely feel like his death happens too early in this, because I really wanted more sort of him, you know, maybe him at the bar, you know, let it go on for a day, because we only get the morning and then those altercations at the job site to really let it sink in. Even though it does sink in, I just was really missing him around for the rest of the film.
Well, we're going to just jump right into this part. I would have liked to see more of his interactions with his stepfather, Philip Seymour Hoffman, here. It was kind of I didn't really know. I mean, we could infer the relationship slightly. But also,
we just didn't get an understanding of why he was the piece of shit he was. You know? I guess you're happy when he dies in the sense of a bad character, not happy in the sense that he's a good actor that you want to see more of. But Yeah, I agree. Like, it would have been great to see him interact with our main man.
And nobody really thinks that this movie is good, by the way. This is not...
This was a John Slattery film, right?
John Slattery, first-time director.
And Roger Sterling. And I was no wonder Christina Hendricks is in this movie, because always... Again, I'm in season two, no spoilers for Mad Men, but always had a thing for Joan, at least through the first, I don't know, 25 episodes or something. So, Roger Sterling, Joan... all that sort of stuff. No spoilers, please.
I like him as an actor, and I love her. And if we remember another Mike Manzi callback, Charlie Wilson's War. They had a really good scene together, Philip Seymour Hoffman and him.
I wonder if that's where their friendship budded, and that's where it came
from. Apparently they know each other from the theater circuit.
From theater days? Okay.
Yeah. But, I don't know. They work together in this film, but it's... 38% critics on Rotten Tomatoes, 32% audience. Seems about right.
Yeah, I mean, I just wanted to watch this because, like you said, it comes at the end of his career. It's one of the last things he ever shot. I was just really curious to get a sense of him as an actor at this stage, knowing, you know, what happens in a little while to him and everything like that. And, like, I don't know. I think he... I recognize him visually, but, like, as a performance, this is, like, nothing like I really feel like he's ever done. It's so sort of muted and reserved and restrained and everything. He never really, like, blows up that much. Like, I don't know. I found it very interesting to watch him at this point.
I mean, it's interesting that he, again, plays a character with an addictive personality. I mean, this is just something we've seen time and time again. Unfortunately...
Was it gambling in this? Because that, I felt...
Yeah, gambling, and he definitely has... gambling, and he definitely enjoys his alcohol, but yeah, gambling more than that.
Like, everything is there in this movie. It just needs to be sort of pumped up a level, you know? Like, the gambling stuff with the horse and Totoro, like, that's not exactly clear. The stuff with the son, like, that's, you know, that could have taken a little more time. You know, the stuff with the reporter, when we get to the reporter, like, I feel like that's very sort of loosey-goosey.
Oh, yeah.
You know? Like, not very concrete.
I guess the thing I liked most about it, and I mean, I am not a fan of the city of Philadelphia, I'll leave it at that, but I like the world building they're doing. I think they do a good job of, like, at least, like, the local watering hole. I think it's called the Hollywood Bar.
Yeah, and just, but, like, I feel like it could have been any city. Like, I, for a long time, thought this was, like, Pittsburgh. Because I think this is the kind of city that, like, Pittsburgh is normally painted at. For it to be Philadelphia, like, when I saw that on the cop car, I was like, oh, huh, okay. And I feel like this is the kind of movie that you could tell about any city. And I think they shot it in, like, Brooklyn or something. They shot it in New York, but it played as Philly.
Jersey and Yonkers.
I just didn't get a real sense of, like, a city or a place as opposed, like, a specific place as opposed to just, like, a very good telling of, like, that type of place. No. You know what I mean? Like, I didn't get realistic blue-collar town, which in my mind was why I remember liking this movie, because it felt, like, gritty and real and raw. And then I was just like, oh, there's not a lot happening here. And... the plot is just, like, kind of dumb.
So was that the story you originally liked this movie?
Yeah. Well, when I watched it in theaters, I liked it. I mean, I never loved it, but I remembered liking it because I also saw in theaters around the same time was A Most Wanted Man, and that's a very different kind of movie. And, like, I'm not really super into spy movies, like espionage movies. Like, I think that they are needlessly complicated a lot of the time. And so, like, in my brain, I equate the two because they either came out the same year or within a year of each other. And so when you gave us the list of, like, the short list of things that were left, and I saw those two, I was like, well, I like this one more, but I remembered liking it more than I actually wound up this time around.
Yeah, I think for me what kind of stands out about this movie is, like, I like Kyle said, the world building stuff, like, almost like that movie Joe with Nick Cage. Like, that movie does the best job of sort of portraying, you know, this town or this environment that's just been run down by the economy and is on its last leg and just struggling to survive. Like, that movie does it perfectly. This movie does it well, you know, like, I feel like that's what it's trying to accomplish also, is that it's not per se about this very thin story about a suspicious death on the job. Like, that's basically the story, and, like, the locals are investigating that. But I mean,
is this movie a period piece?
Yes.
Correct me. I wasn't sure.
I didn't pick up on that. I don't know.
Yeah, I wasn't sure. It's just a neighborhood with people that have, like, you know, older cars and, like.
No, it's based on a short story. It's based on a short story. They're not that behind. It's in the 70s.
At some point. I did not pick up on that. Because I got like almost a Soprano-y kind of vibe in the beginning. When
it's based on a short story, and it's supposed to take place when the short story was written, which was in the 70s. I mean, you don't see any cars that are after the 70s.
Like, but I think that sort of plays into the same vibe that it's giving. Like, it is of an era, but I don't think it's specific to an era. You know what I mean? Like, it's the same.
It's like
it's a blue-collar town, but not a specific town. And it's like of a generation gone by, but not a specific one. And it's like it's doing things well, but it's almost like I wonder if it was intentionally not vague, but like left open to semi-interpretation, so that you could sort of fit it to your city or your time. Or what? Because I mean, the thing that the story that happens here could happen anywhere. It's just I don't know.
If that's the case, that I think that's like a really dumb choice, because it's God's pocket and it's supposed to be about this neighborhood. It's essentially from what I understand, the short story is the equivalent of like those Southie Boston short stories. It's supposed to be a real Philadelphia thing. Hence, Richard Jenkins' character, that writer, like the narrator, he's like talking about like, oh, my city, you know? But you're absolutely right. We don't get that. I'm the first one to criticize like really obvious establishing shots, but we could have used like some Philly establishing shots.
Yeah. I don't know. I agree with Joey. I think that's what he was going for, and I also agree with you, Brian. I don't feel like he pulled it off. I mean, no one says John once in this whole movie. Did they just not say that in the 70s? I thought this was Jersey a lot of the time, too. So it's weird how, you know, I want it to be more specific and expounded and sort of, like, detailed, but it also, like, kind of worked for me in the sense that it's, like, you know, anywhere. It could be any. There's a town like this in every state. You know, there's, you know, the economy is hitting everyone. And it is weird that this is supposed to be the 70s, because it totally, like, just fit as if it was supposed to be today for me. Like, I, you know, that maybe that's another point.
I think it also would exist today. Like, I think that's the kind of town, the kind of people that, whether it's the 70s or the 80s or today, would still be in that same bar. You know, if you track this story, it's probably their kids or their grandkids in that same bar with the same bar owner's grandkids running the bar. Like, it feels like these are the kind of people that never leave the town. That, like, Richard Jenkins, and you have to be like a pretty boring character for me not to get like a journalism boner about your character, but like I was not into him at all, and I am like all in on journalism movies. But
I thought about you, Joey. I was like, this is like the dark side of what could have been Lewandowski, like stuck in some basement in some town in the middle of nowhere.
Just terrible.
The dark side. Do you see the ladies he gets in this film?
He gets that one lady.
Well, he does sleep with Christina Hendricks, but he also sleeps with Sophia Tikal, who is great in all of Joe Swanberg's movies. She also directed a movie called Always Shine, which is great. Like, she's just this actress that sort of like floats around the indie scene and is just really, really good. She's also, I think, she's also in Ty West's segment of VHS in that second honeymoon. I've really liked her for a long time. And like, she's just here just to get naked. Like, it's just like, I wish there was more. Like, it's just, hey, this predatory journalist that doesn't have a groupie. Life. What's that?
He's got a groupie. I was like, where is this coming from? But
he's aggressive towards Christina Hendricks, but her, she was just in the bar and just like saying that she's a student from,
Temple.
Went there. What? Temple, thank you. Yeah.
So we've mentioned some of the cast, Kyle. Do you want to walk us through the cast?
Sure. In the role of Mickey Scarpato, we've got Philip Seymour Hoffman, then his wife, Jeannie, played by Christina Hendricks, then Richard Shelburne, played by Richard Jenkins, Arthur Bird Capezio, played by John Turturro.
And they've been in the same film together, but not on screen together.
Big Lebowski,
yes.
Yes. And then we've got Smiling Jack Moran, played by Eddie Marsan. They've been in a film and a scene together, Mission Impossible 3.
Yes.
I thought he was good in it. I liked him.
Eddie Marsan, too, like, full-on Brit, like, doing a great accent. Like, he's done some other show on cable, too, where he's got,
we've said it before. What's the John Voight, Liev Schreiber?
Oh, Ray Donovan.
Ray Donovan.
Yeah, he's on that show. He's awesome on that show.
And then Leon Hubbard, played by Caleb Landry. And then Sal Cappy, played by Dominic Lombardozzi.
Herc.
And then
Herc from The Wire.
To The Wire.
From The Wire, yeah. And then Coleman Peetz, played by Glenn Fleshler, who is just as terrifying in this as he was in True Detective Season 1. I think.
Oh, that's where he's spaghetti faced. That's right. Yeah, I knew him from somewhere. I was like, don't fuck
with that
guy.
He is just so freaking intense. I mean, he was also on Boardwalk Empire. He is an intense, like, intimidating actor. Mm-hmm. And just
he's a presence.
Being
he's
got, he was,
Kyle, he was in that movie, The You and I Like Too, A Most Violent Year.
Oh, Oscar Isaac. Yeah, I really like that movie, and that is a movie I haven't seen since we saw it in theaters.
It's on Prime, or it was. Yeah, he's like one of like the rival oil men or whatever.
Ah, okay, yeah. Nice, I'll have to check that out again.
Yeah, he has a great face, you know, a great like look about him. Yeah. One more actor, Jack O'Connell, did you mention him?
No, I did not mention him.
He is in Doubt. I recognize his face. So.
Who is he, the bartender or something? I'm just trying to think of the last major character that we haven't really...
I think so.
Either that or maybe the guy... The,
I don't remember any
newspaper.
Other male figures from Doubt. That's a weird thing.
Sorry, he's not the bartender
in that
Doubt.
Movie?
Yeah, he's like another priest.
Okay.
Oh, okay. Yeah, probably just like some...
He's a guy that get cast a lot for his face. You know, his look. He's in a lot of things where he doesn't have a lot of lines.
Is he the bartender or the guy with the neck brace at the bar in this movie?
I know he's... I can't remember. I just wrote that he's at the bar. So
he is the bar. He's playing the bar.
He's the bar. He plays the bar.
Oh, that's where I recognized him from. I've seen him in a lot of films.
Yeah.
He's a method actor.
Sometimes he plays a couch.
No, but this is a movie that was just, like, to me, so... Like, I got bored watching it, if that makes sense.
I was so excited for it to be 88 minutes long, and then I'm like, oh, these are really long 88 minutes.
Yeah, it's one of those movies you, like, keep pausing, like, where am I? I'm here?
It's like a dog year movie, where it's just, like, it's moving so slow. You're like, oh, I guess dogs move fast. Never mind, that's a bad reference, but yeah, it's a time, it keeps you in a black hole. Like, you just get, what time is it? It's going so slow.
It's like the casino without, you know, casinos without, like, the windows, you know, just, like, I'm still here, you know, I don't know.
When every time now, for just, like, bad reasons, when you say, anyone says casino, I think of Reindeer Games.
Wow.
The Throne. It's just one of the most pitiful casinos I've ever seen on film. Go watch that movie, check out the episode.
At cageclub.me.
Dot Emmy.
So
what's
Kyle,
that, it's called the Boom Boom Safe, Mike? Is that what it's called? No. Pow Wow. Pow Wow.
Pow Wow.
The Pow Wow Safe. Pow Wow.
So Kyle, I don't want to forget this. Please, we're getting late into our Hoffman tenure, but do you still got it, Kyle? Do you still got a nice little summary for
our fans? I think this is one of my best ones yet.
Ooh.
All right.
As it's just nothing happens.
Yeah.
As Richard Shelburne says, you can't forgive being from God's pocket. And, with the story of Mickey Scarpato, you can see why. In the blue-collar Philly neighborhood, Leon, a young, racist piece of shit, is killed at his day labor job. This sets the story into motion and getting to see how it affects his mom, stepdad, a local writer, and the neighborhood. Boom.
I like how you started it as, like, this, you know, third-party, objective, you know, quoting things, and then you just drop a racist piece of shit. It's like, oh, okay.
Kyle style. There we go. That's my editorial column.
That's your next podcast.
No.
Kyle
but
style.
It could be.
We don't know.
Yeah, you can get into Fashion Week in New York, like, backstage. That'd be amazing.
So, I mean, I don't know. What do you guys want to talk about this movie? I mean, I'll start off the bat. I like this guy, but I'm not a fan of the direction here. Like, director direction.
He also wrote it, right? Like, he adapted the short story into the screen.
Yes.
Clearly, he's made his Mad Men money. And
it feels like this is like a almost like a passion project thing. Like, I was like, is this like where he grew up, where Slattery's from? Like, how hard does he connect to this material that he felt that this needed to be expanded into a film? And, like, you know,
I think he wanted to, you know, I think he directed some episodes of Mad Men. I think he wanted to branch out as a director. He got all his friends and people he knew to be in the movie. He bought the rights to this story and was like, I'm going to do this. This is going to be awesome. And it just wasn't. I think I see this, and I can't cite anything now, so I apologize. But I see this a lot with, like, actors turn directors. Now, some of them are great. We all know that. But sometimes you get these, like, one-off things where they're just – they give the actors a little too much leeway because they're coming from it in an actor's perspective.
Yeah, yeah, that actor's standpoint, yeah.
Everyone in this movie feels like they're going in different directions and not in a good way.
Hmm. Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah, I mean,
the one thing I could see about it is, like, it's a very small production, so, you know, it's not a huge budget blockbuster. So, like, this is something as a director you can really cut your teeth on.
Yeah, the budget for this was $1 million.
Whoa, okay. That makes it a little more impressive in my eyes.
And it grossed $400,194.
Whoa, that's weird.
Yeah, I mean,
like 12
it's
of
something...
it was from me.
I mean, it was at Sundance. It's surprising because it's like released the year of his death, and you would think there'd be some push.
Yeah, you
to
cash
see
in
it.
On that, you know.
Yeah,
like,
and
the marketing would definitely be like, you know, one of his last performances of one of the best actors of the last, you know, of his
and it age. Was like that, and it was, and it didn't really make a difference.
Oh,
or maybe
yeah,
it did.
He passed away, I think, only, like, 2 weeks after Sundance. It was, and like Brian said, they showed this in A Most Wanted Man.
Because this is definitely the kind of thing I would expect more of from Hoffman than Hunger Games, you know, which is, like, where he kind of goes out with. He kind of leaves with Hunger Games, right? Like, that's the end of the line for him. So, I mean,
yeah,
this
like
is
Brian
something
said, this was the last full performance, and then part two, they filled in, like, did the CGI.
Like, in an odd way, this feels sort of like a more fitting farewell than something like that, in my mind, in my eyes, for an actor like him. I mean, it's just, you know, where it's coming from is that indie, you know, kind of thing where they, you know, just kind of working it out as they're, you know, as it's going and just trying to do the best they can. Like, it just has that sort of indie spirit.
Yeah, it just has the vibe that even the films that he took early in his career have.
Yeah, that's
great. Yeah,
it definitely does. It just, this is, like, I was reading a lot of, like, the press for this and just, like, stories, and apparently at this Sundance where Most Wanted Man and this premiered, he was like a wreck. I've seen interviews from them the time. You could see in his body that he doesn't look great. But
well, there's the really creepy like tin picture that was taken of him, you know, like a little timey photo. And he just looks so, I mean, it doesn't help that it's like...
No, it doesn't help that it's like the tin type, but still.
Yeah. But, like, he just looks so disheveled and, like, just done, like, just real, honestly, like, just very, like, almost, not to be weird about it, but, like, done with life. He just looks very...
Well, this is, like, a lot of people said, like, at, like, Sundance parties, he was just, like, a jerk.
Well, this character has, like, a very defeated quality about him, you know, and so maybe he wasn't really stretching at this point, you know, that this was just something he took because he could really express this. It's what he was feeling.
That's a good point, because the one thing I do like about his character that's, like, he feels like he's a guy who has a lot of cachet in the community, despite not being from there, but he's so afraid not to, like be there for his wife in terms of like not being able to pay for the casket and stuff like that, and that pretty much like guides the entire film. I don't know. I thought that was one of like the cool things about it. I don't know, but they didn't really have a lot of chemistry despite that early sex scene.
No, it doesn't really make. I think she was kind of, it was wrong casting on, I think, for her character.
I thought she was going to be portrayed as, like, a trophy wife and that he was going to sort of be hot shit for, like, what he does, but he's not, you know? Like, he's like, yeah, he's just like a driver. Like, he's sort of just like, yeah. He, like that one guy says, he's like, you don't got a job, you've got something on the side, you know? Like, he's not a big-time gangster or anything, and, like, he turns out to be a cuckold in the end,
but
too,
maybe so, he like, was. Like, maybe that's the backstory we don't have, because, like, I think you're right, that there's no way that they're married, and he doesn't use that to, like, advance himself in society at some point, but we have no history or indication that any of that was there. Like, he's just a guy,
yeah,
like a
schlub,
who is broke and trying to hustle and just sort of like in Before the Devil Knows Your Dad, like trying to make a quick buck in all the wrong ways. And I mean, I guess because it's a movie, like things don't work out for him. But it's just, he has nothing going for him, even though from the outside, it looks like he's got this beautiful wife, you know, he's got this kid, this, you know, energetic kid, for lack of a better word, and, you know, that it all sort of crumbles, or maybe there was nothing there to begin with, I don't know.
I mean, he certainly garners respect, like, at the bar and stuff. He's not one of the people they treat like
shit.
Yeah,
but I love at the end how the guy says, fuck you, you're not from here. Like, when he starts defending Richard.
Yeah,
Lincoln,
I wonder, is it, like, was he just the one who was able to put up with that kid and, like, put him in his place to earn his seat at that table or something? Is that a part of it? And, yeah, and so people, like, respect him because they're able to, like, get that kid in line from time to time or not. I don't know.
Something that I don't know if you guys read about or anything, but, like, this is supposed to be a dark comedy.
You know, I wrote that down. No, I wrote that down because there was a point in the middle where he's wheeling the body around where, like, they find the body out back and, like, he props him up and, like, stands him against the wall and he falls over. I'm like, is this a comedy now? Like, there
it's
feels like...
It's actually supposed to be, like, the short story is a dark comedy.
No, yeah, it is supposed to be, like, yeah.
It's not.
Think
about that weird ending of the trailer in Florida and just those gunshots going
off. That was in Florida. Like, yeah. I was so bad. That was such an abrupt, baffling ending for me. Like, it made the movie so much worse in that regard.
Well,
like,
you don't remember that one little reference to say, she's looking at trailers down in Florida. I'm like, come on, who are you?
I mean, and that to me is where, if anywhere, I've picked up on any kind of dark comedy is the Totoro stuff. That with the flower shop owner and their sort of patter and back and forth, and when they come in to kill her and she blows them away, and then Totoro's like, what's going on? And she's like, you gotta be calm, go change your pants, you know, you don't want blood on your shoes. And he's like, all right, I'm going. And, like, you know, it just felt sitcom-y at that point. I was like, where did this come from? But to say that this whole movie is supposed to be, you know not laugh out loud funny, but sort of like, you know, funny, I don't pick up on it.
No, it's like, again, it's a dark comedy missing the laughs. Like, there are a couple funny moments, but not more than they would be in any film worth its salt, you know?
Like, this is the moment where Jenkins is talking into his tape recorder at a stoplight, and those dudes pull up alongside of him, and, like, that is, like, a wasted comedic moment, you know? Like, that was primed to be funny, and I feel like if anything they dropped the ball there, but that is another moment that they were probably like, this is hilarious in the context of what we're doing. Like, this is an actual guffaw laugh, whereas the rest of the movie is just like a thinking laugh.
Kyle, were there any like particular scenes you wanted to talk about or discuss?
Oh, I had one more thing about sort of like, I guess, the dynamic between Hoffman and his wife's sisters. Like, I got a very Homer, Patty, Selma thing coming from them. And,
oh,
like, there,
totally,
now
that
I think about it, like, that could have been played much more for comedic effect also, because he kind of comes in at night and is like, which one are you? Like, I don't know who you are. And he goes to, like, take a phone call, and they don't even talk to him. He, like, looks, he's like, it was a friend asking about what happened, and they just shut the door in his face. Like, there are all these little moments there that they could have maybe exploited.
I feel like
it's
the same performance in a lot of movies, that he's just, like, this guy who's tired. I mean, you were saying that when they were at Sundance, like, he sort of was, like, done with life. It feels like here it's the same kind of thing. Like, it says always to me, you know, not having seen every one of his movies, but it's, like, this guy who's just world-weary and, like, it feels like every character he plays never wants to wake up in the morning. Like, that's what I get. And, like, it's the same thing here. Like, he just has nothing going for him. Every day is a grind. Nothing is good in his life.
I mean, I don't agree with that. There's plenty of positive, upbeat characters. characters he plays. Like, he has a lot of buddy roles. I mean, Dusty and Twister, that guy wants to wake up.
I'm just saying, no. Night. I'm saying recently. I'm saying, like, okay. Since he became an old man and as he was about to die. I mean, Art Howe is sort of the same way, too, right? And
yes.
Before the Devil Knows You're Dead, it's the same way. Like, all these recent ones that I've watched, that I've been on, it feels the same. Like, it feels, and even, you know, in the Hunger Games movies, he's not the most energetic guy. He's just sort of like, I don't know that he's coasting, but it feels like how the same way that like Cage is doing a lot of similar roles now, it feels like he was sort of falling into this trap of like, you're going to get a strong performance, but like, this is the Philip Seymour Hoffman role or the type or the character.
Yeah, I mean, his last one that, I mean, he gave it his all and was just the Master, which
the Master
is
there, yeah, that's all I'm thinking in my mind, yeah.
Yeah, which is 2012, so you
maybe
know,
he just spent it all on that, you know, because
well, no, again, that's what we talked. I mentioned it on that episode. It's after that movie that he had his like first drink in 18 years.
Wow.
So, yeah, it's unfortunately one of those roles that just
well, that's a hard drinking movie too. So it's about, you know, alcoholism is a huge sort of like, it's all over that movie. So.
Yeah,
you know, the temptation. I could see it.
Yeah, we'll get into this more when we like recap this third act. But it's certainly something. It's something I've definitely noticed as well. I think I would have liked to see, because he's a great actor and he had it in him. But I think I would have liked to see like probably him obviously survive, but take some time off, recoup, and then come back to it because. It's not to the level where he's like mailing it in, but it's certainly not, it doesn't feel like he's being challenged anymore or challenging the kind of roles, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, it's almost like what's being presented to him, and then when he, you know, yeah, when he goes, again, it's not him phoning it in, but it's,
I think just as an actor, you get typecast, you know, and this is a stretch. Like, Keanu went through, like, long stretches where he was just one character over and over and over again, you know? It's like he's a... And we even had a category on the awards, you know, where he's, like, a cop, a blank slate, you know, like this, that. Like, he's an archetypal, like, manifestation. And, like, as an actor, he's great like that. And I think maybe Hoffman, you know, he's never... I don't really feel like he's ever been typecast before, necessarily. Like, he's always done interesting, weird, strange things, whether it be, like, Big Lebowski and Boogie Nights or, you know, The Master and stuff. So, like, this is sort of, like, in a weird way, I feel maybe his typecast period. And that could maybe, you know, add to some strain and, you know, just getting bored or burnt out or, you know,
yeah,
for
an
actor of his caliber, especially for someone who's not used to maybe, you know, doing, you know, 4 action movies in a row and then like 3 comedies in a row or whatever, like a Keanu or a Cage or something like that. Like, I could see where it might sort of like wear on you a bit.
Yeah, and it doesn't help that this is like a kind of like a lazy movie, and then a first-time director that, if I was going to guess, I'd agree with Brian that since he's an actor, he's kind of just like, maybe his directing theory is just like, oh, I think the two best, if I was going to say two things I liked about this movie, I said the one already, that I like just the showing of this neighborhood. Yes, it's not defined Philadelphia, but you know, I think they did a good job that is as far as the characters in the neighborhood, and then on top of that, it is like he just did a good job, whether it's him pulling in favors as an actor and other actors, or the casting directors are really good. It's a, you know, it's a good cast, or it's good actors.
If the budget was only $1 million, then everyone worked for scale, you know, and it was just like, let's do something for our buddy, which is great. I like when actors do that just for the project. It's nice to see, but it's unfortunate that it's kind of wasted here.
Yeah, the other end of that coin is that you just don't have the resources on to pull off, like, whether it be a rewrite or, you know, we need these establishing shots or we can't get permits to shoot, like, at the museum or whatever, it, you know, the more famous locations, you know, you run into all other kinds of problems. It's almost like, what if he raised more money and got no names and tried to make this, you know, with another pass, you know, like, did he sort of blow his wad his first time out by calling in all of his favors, or, you know, it's hard to
tell. Well, clearly he doesn't have much of a directing career now.
No, but I mean, he's still got, you know, Howard Stark money coming in from Marvel from time to time, so it's not like...
Oh, no, no, I don't think he blew his money wad, but I think he blew his cachet wad.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying, too, is, like, it's very tricky. It's a tricky line to walk there. I would have maybe thought he would have maybe done better with a bunch of, like, lesser-known actors that he could sort of direct. You know, maybe he got a little intimidated by the caliber of actor he was dealing with as a director. That's all.
Since they were going after this dark comedy tone, I wonder, and this is something I feel like I comment on directing, writing, and like cinematography, acting, but I don't talk much about editing. I'm wondering through the power of editing and like if they just like, I mean, maybe different takes, or just if shots were shorter, or just like, or longer takes, or just even the music they used, if you could edit this into
interesting
dark comedy.
Music would be the easiest way, because you show a shot of schlubby Hoffman with some like funnier music over it, and then, you know, it's like, oh, okay, I'm supposed to,
well,
like,
they
I'm
have
with.
They have funny music when they're moving the body around the first time. Like, there's weird music there that just never comes back.
Yeah.
And I was like, why? Like, that's what confused me, because up to that point, there's no comedy. And then after that point, like, whenever we cut to Richard Jenkins, like, there's no comedy. It's like, what is... the tone is just so goofy.
Maybe I'm saying this subconsciously because, or, I mean, I'm recognizing it now, but because John Turturro, you know, being Big Lebowski in plenty of Coen Brothers movies, and then Richard Jenkins, like, Burn After Reading Coen Brothers, like, it does have, like, a... Or maybe they're going for a Coen Brothers vibe, or, like, there could be, if you tried to make it more of a dark comedy through different kind of editing, it would have, like, a poor man's Coen Brothers vibe. I don't know, but I think that's what they were... Like, you know, because I did read some of the same things that they tried to make this.
I could see that as being sort of the target, I guess. But
yeah, being the target.
Money for Nothing with Cusack pulled that off better, I feel. Like, that, you know what I'm saying? Like, for a Philly dark comedy, like, that is the movie to watch. Like, that has Benny D.T. in it, Benicio Del Toro. He's great in this. He steals that movie.
Oh, yeah, wow.
You know, like,
so
it
long
gets
ago,
crazy.
I forgot about that.
Yeah, like, that movie starts off, and you're like, whoa, it's like a working man drama. And it's like, no, this is going to be, like, a weird and wacky sort of working man, like, who got this money, you know, like, we found stolen money and what are we going to do with it, comedy kind of thing. So, I mean, it is possible to pull off. That's a better representation, I think.
I guess if we were going to play, Brian, you started asking earlier if we're a scene. I think the scene, the one that he first talks to Smiling Jack, again, played by Eddie Marsan, that's just a good talking scene. And I mean, at least, I mean, Mike agreed with me that he was, Eddie was good in this movie, or interesting as far as his voice and character he created. So, yeah, might as well. We'll play that scene of him looking at coffins for his stepson Leon.
Jack. Mickey.
I'm so sorry to hear about Leon.
Yeah.
Sometimes you wonder about God's plan.
I just want to make Ginny feel better.
Let me show you what we got, Nick. This is our bestseller. Mahogany veneer, champagne interior.
What about that one?
Of course, you know Ginny best, but she ain't gonna want some piece of junk.
I gotta think it over.
Nick, we'll work something out.
I just don't want to give her anything she ain't gonna like.
Well, how about I stop over tomorrow morning? It might be easy if I had to talk about it in familiar surroundings.
I guess so.
Yo, Mick. Was the body messed up?
No, his body's fine. It's just the back of his head.
It's no problem at all. The back of the head takes care of itself.
You gotta get the mahogany finish with the velvet interior. Or whatever.
Exactly. That's the, you know, you knew that. I mean, I think that Eddie Marsan did it that was a fun character. I mean, he's the one that ends up creating that awkward scene, like you said, Joey, of the body outside. Like, you knew that he was like a slimy character that, you know, wasn't something wasn't going to go right, that it wasn't just going to take that $700.
I love how in the opening, like, that sort of the funeral that we see, like, he just gets punched in the face.
Yeah.
You don't really know why, and then a few scenes later, you see him at the bar and knock some guy out or something like that, and you're like, oh, okay, that's going to come back around or something.
Speaking of face violence, the only other note that I have is when the guy gets his eye squished out, which is...
Ooh. Ugh.
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about with that guy Glenn Fleshler and his, like, and he's just like, that's, like, freaking crazy. Actually, no, there's another face, and this is, I think, one of the weirder parts of the movie. And actually kind of reminds me of awkward editing now in Before the Devil Knows You're Dead, is when Philip Seymour Hoffman is, like, full-on sprinting after that truck, and then he falls, and it's, like, a weird shot of him, like, in the air, and you hear a very bad, like, sound, like, effect of car crash. Like, it sounded very comical.
Yeah,
that was weird.
That was to me, is a very weird moment. But yeah, that eye, the thumb to the eye, that was pretty intense.
I had one. I actually had one quote written down, and Hoffman's at the bar talking. I think he's talking to the bartender, and it's the night that the kid dies. And the bartender is, like, hammered. And he goes, "The night my mom died,
I wrote this too.
I fucking lost it at that line. I thought that was perfect, the delivery and everything. I mean, there's your comedy. Make the movie about the bartender and the barflies and all that kind of thing, you know? He had a real, like, you know, keeping in with the Simpsons things, he had a real Mo Sizlak thing going on with that joint. Like, it was one of the dingiest dives I'd ever seen on film.
Did you guys? Yeah, no, I agree, and it's like, because so Kyle, I'm kind of going more on your side now in terms of, like, they did set some settings really well, but
yeah, I think they established, like, an interesting neighborhood again. Like, I mean, I think the first time I saw this, I thought it was New York, maybe because I had read that they shot in Yonkers or something like that. But yeah, so it's not specifically.
Oh my God! I know where that bar is. Now that you mention it, I know exactly where that bar is in Yonkers that they shot at.
A God's Pocket tour.
Yeah, we can do a little.
It's based on a town called Devil's Pocket, which is somewhere. I don't know why.
It's a neighborhood in Philadelphia.
Okay.
Yeah, that's so stupid. But it's from the short story. So that wasn't like the film's fault.
Before the Devil's Pocket knows you're dead.
Yeah. That would have been weird if they had the same title.
The Devil's God's Pocket Protector. Be like a sequel.
Oh, I was like, what? Oh God. Maybe.
Manzi, since you said, like, you really liked that line from the bartender, I wrote one other line down, and it's the scene after when Mickey is, like, on the couch and Christina Hendricks finds him, and she goes, "What time is it?" And I just love the way he goes, "Closing time."
Yeah.
Like, there is, like, good moments like that you're like, ooh, I do want, like, just like this. I don't know, I guess...
He never gets back to that, though. That's the problem. You know, like, he reveals, oh, this character can be, like, funny and drunk and, like, you know, it's the moment of death, like, he's making a joke. And then, like, the rest of the movie, there's none of that. Like, it's like Joey said, it becomes Looney Tunes. Like, his character's chasing a dead body half the movie. It's like...
You know, yeah. Like, it's... Yeah, exactly. I think Joey was saying it before that it's a... You know, that the situation, like, gets bad, but then it gets good. But then it also, like, then does get bad for... Like, again, that, like... It goes from, obviously, this... So the initial incident is that this... That his stepson is killed, and then we meet, like, the mob world from that, and almost, like, John Turturro has stuff going on the side.
They steal meat, basically. It's like, they hijack meat.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then, obviously, through that, and that's how those guys, you know, Dominic Lombardozzi goes to Glenn Fleshler, and that happens, and then he gets the $1,400, but I think, the casket's like $4,000 or something like that, but he gets $1,400 from locals, but then gambles that away, but then John Turturro gives him $700. Point being, like, in the end, like, then it kind of works out, but then we find out that Christina Hendricks slept with Richard Jenkins. Like,
well, I do want to talk about
that. It's just a very all-over, up-and-down movie, you know?
What did you think about that dynamic between Richard Jenkins and Christina Hendricks?
The Christina, the Jeannie and Richard relationship?
Yeah.
I mean, it's really weird and awkward. I mean, just the fact, again, like, I mean, so this guy, you know, has groupies, and he says at, like, one point, like, oh, I'm a local hero. Like, his character is kind of interesting. Like, do you think he was kind of sick of it and did specifically go into that place just to get completely, like, the shit kicked out of him? Because he was kind of, like, he has a drinking problem and maybe doesn't want to be this hero to them anymore? Like,
no, I don't think so. I think he's just, like, arrogant. And
yeah, I think he's just got a warped perspective, you know? Like,
okay, yeah.
That kind of thing. He's an alcoholic now, and he's just lost touch. But I wish we had more time with him, and it's very awkward how they, like, take a trip to the country.
Yeah.
And
well,
like,
it's just really awkward. He's in her son's room, and he, like, lies down on the bed, and then she kind of snuggles up next to him after real... Like, I think maybe... it's not like he's a...
Well, he takes advantage of her,
He's a journalist, but is he, like, a big-time investigative journalist? It's almost like she thinks that he can, like, will, like, look into the case further, you know?
I couldn't... So where's the sex appeal with this guy? Like, that's what's killing me. Like, why are these women, like, if not throwing themselves at him, like, complicit with his advances and stuff? Like, he practically... forces himself upon Christina Hendricks. Like, she's grieving, and he's just running his hand up her skirt, and she, you know what I'm saying? Like, it happens, but, like, you know, she's just not stopping it. It's not, I don't get the sense that she wants it, per se, at that moment. So I just don't get
Do you
what
think
it
that's her motivation?
That's attractive.
Do you think her motivation is just that, like, oh, if I sleep with him, he'll find more information out?
The two vibes I got was, like, yes, there is a part, like, oh, maybe he'll, like, he is a popular writer, so maybe he'll be able to use his resources somehow, but then also, like, the look on her face is completely just, like, oh my god, I don't know what to do, I'll just let this happen, like, very victimized, so it's kind of 50-50 in my, or maybe even more that and less the uses resources.
What do you think ended up happening to her character?
She just, like the other, she just stays in God's pocket, and she probably ends up with some other alcoholic guy or something like that. I mean,
okay,
that's kind of the story, right? That's the, what's that?
I said K.
Well, it's kind of weird. Like, at the end, like, there's really nowhere to go. Like, if you see where Hoffman ends up, he's basically, you know, in purgatory, for lack of a better word. Like, he's gone from God's pocket
to
Florida. Yeah, Florida, which is just, well, maybe he's in hell. If he's in Florida, but I don't know. Like,
wow,
this is
just a podcast of, like, dissing regions of the United States.
Well, Jersey rules, O'Doyle rules. just being fun. But no, I'm just, you know, just like he, you know, he. It's not like he's free either after this incident. He has to go into hiding. Like, he is, you know, hiding out, lying low, not doing anything. So. Yeah, I have the sense that she's sort of still around town.
What is the ending? He goes down, and you've got, like, the, you know, you've got Bird, and who is Sophia to him? Is that his mother? Is that his aunt? Almost at the end, it feels like it's supposed to be his wife, like, in a way. It's really weird. But they have this one line, like, oh, you gotta be ready for when they come. Like, are they expecting, like, a mob lash out from those two guys being killed at the florist? Like, I don't... like, it was very awkward.
Yeah, I think so.
And just, like, okay. Yeah, yeah.
Kyle. Yeah. Are they a couple? Because that's what I thought towards the end. I'm like, okay.
Yeah, in the beginning... Because she... Yeah, I mean, obviously a wife would say, like, oh, what am I going to do with... Like, because she has some kind of line, like, what am I going to do, like, without him, like, when the guys come in there to, you know, shoot him or whatever... But it just, like, since she was older and looks older than John Turturro, like, it just had a very, like he's the son that takes care of his mom, but then she takes care of business in a way.
It's weird that becomes a thread, you know? Like, it's just very strange that expands into, like, a whole storyline, you know? That we're even asking these questions, like, are they married? Are they mother-son?
Yeah.
Like, what is their relationship? Like, why are we asking those questions about that in this movie? Like... It should have just been that scene and over with, or you know, like, I don't know. I feel like the movie wants to explore all this stuff it doesn't have time to, and it's not sticking to the issue, which is pretty weak, because deep down it's just like, whodunit? It's like this investigation that isn't happening, basically. Like, cops are not involved. The mafia gets you know, their ass kicked, and Jenkins basically, like, drinks himself into a stupor. So, like, nothing is resolved. So why go off on these tangents, and instead let's just try and focus on making what we can solid. So I just started getting frustrated when those things happened. Especially with that ending. I hated the ending. I hated...
It's just a sloppy movie with a few too many tangents, I guess.
It's just not interesting enough. It should be interesting. You have a guy die 2/3 times, but it's not... I don't know. I was bored. We'll put it that way.
Well, and that's why we brought on secret guest John Slattery. John's been listening this whole time.
I would feel so embarrassed. I'd be like, "Oh my god, I'm so sorry. I really love this movie. Everyone else didn't like it.
We've been trashing this movie. You know, I still gave it 2 stars. Like, I feel like if you want to see what Hoffman did toward the end of his life, like, it's worth checking out. You know, like, if you're a completist, or I mean, I don't. You know what I'm saying? Like, you could. I've seen a lot worse that have tried to do stuff like this, you know. The problem is there's a lot better also. Like, Joe is a fantastic movie. I think that just hits these issues, you know, more clearly and better. And,
what did you give Joe? Yeah. How many stars?
5 stars for
Joe. Wow.
Yeah, that's a great...
I've never seen it.
If that's 2.5 Scott's pockets.
I've never seen Joe, so that's a heavy recommendation.
Joe's awesome. Yeah,
I feel like there's a lot of movies that do this type of thing better. Like, I know that, like, and what's annoying is that it's close. You know what I mean? Like, it's almost there. I don't know how you fix it. I don't know how you spice it up. You gotta bring life to it somehow, I think. Whether it's just a more dynamic central performance, or whether it's sort of a streamlining of ideas, or whether it's just tonal consistency. Like, something has to happen here. Because, like, there's the bones of it are good. It's just the things around it, the way that they all play with each other. It doesn't work.
I think that's a great way to put it. I think that's a great way. Like exactly what you said, life. This film has no life. Like, it's... Something's there. We know where it's going, kind of, but it's just, like, listless, you know?
Yeah, I think if we just didn't kill the kid so soon, like, his energy would have brought a lot of sort of credence to the rest of the film. Like, when he goes, like, if he had been much, you know, if we had gotten just 1 or 2 more scenes of that energy, like, he's intense in this movie. Like, I'm scared of him. And he's like half my age, you know, but he's just very violent and scary. And if we had just had maybe another scene of him until he got it, then that might have just sort of helped move it along a little bit. But
so I didn't watch a lot of theater movies last year, and obviously I knew he had a big year. Does he often play characters like this?
Well, not in 3 Billboards. He was very different. He was very... I mean, he gets thrown out of a window in that movie.
he's great in 3 Billboards, though. Like, holy shit, he's...
Yeah. In Get Out, he's more like this. Like, he's very menacing in that movie, I feel.
In Twin Peaks, he's kind of like this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I guess it's kind of his type.
He's got the face for it.
What did you say?
Got the face for it.
I've never seen him skinnier or greasier than he is in this movie. Like, he's definitely amping up his persona. Like, he's not usually this extreme. He's also in the Florida Project, which is not... He's actually kind of, like, normal. Like, he's like a normal guy in that, which is sort of a weird turn.
And he's normal in 3 Billboards, right?
Well, he is, but he's also...
He's kind of a wise ass. Yes. You know? Yeah.
Yeah, okay, sure. I mean, I guess that would fall into his X-Men first class.
Yeah.
Oh, for sure.
Pretty much,
yes.
Right.
And he's definitely
and
a little bit of a wise ass.
He is an American Maid. Who is he an American Maid? Mike, did you see
that?
Oh,
he's the... He's Tom Cruise's brother-in-law. He's the younger brother of his wife who, like, is always having money trouble, and then...
Right.
He starts causing problems for the operation and everything, and, like, he works at the hangar, and he's just mopping floors, but then he finds out what's going on and everything, so... He's kind of a loose cannon in that
so,
movie.
So, again, it's falling right into his character type trope, whatever.
Fine. If he does it good, fine. Whatever. So, anything else you want to discuss for God's Pocket?
I mean, I wish there was, and, like, and to repeat what Joey said, I don't know how this movie could be fixed, but I think they're... I almost, like, want, like, someone to go and take, like, this footage and, like, almost, like, try to re-edit it and maybe put it in, like, a different order or put more of that weird music to it. I don't know. But, no, I guess it's one of his last films, and it's, you know, getting to that sad time of we're almost through his career. So
yeah, as much as he kind of wasn't himself towards the end, he obviously didn't know he was going to die, and so it's not like he could have planned his career where he just ended on like an amazing film. We're just gonna get, we had Hunger Games last week, but we have some new Hunger Games coming up, which I, you know, he's partially CGI. Can't wait to talk about that. But you know,
something in common with the Fast and Furious. I'm sorry. What's the correct name of the podcast?
Too Fast, Too Forever.
Too Fast, Too Forever. Yeah.
Too Fast.
So we're gonna get a CGI Brian at some point. Yeah.
Can I
forgot that they did that, so like that they were doing stuff. I mean, I remember they did it with Gladiator because it was like hard, and The Crow, because those were like circumstantial, like it had sort of been, you know, the movie was so close to being done. But I didn't realize they were doing like crafting digital performances for Hoffman during the Hunger Games. And so I thought they were just matting in previous footage and things. So that's interesting.
No, they did some CGI stuff, and then they wanted to do more, but it just like wasn't possible. So then they take scenes that were supposed to be his and give it to like Woody Harrelson, for instance. So.
Oh, okay. Nowadays you can just General Tarkin. We have him.
Yeah, but it was one, and we'll discuss this when we get to Hunger Games. But it was one of these films and like this recent thing that really propelled this idea of doing that, because it's a big budget franchise film where a guy just doesn't make it, you know, towards the end. And it's not like something like Harry Potter where there's like 90 million of them and you just recast Dumbledore. It was kind of important. It's interesting, the first movie I ever saw do that, and I can't remember the title, but it was a Bruce Lee film that was shot like after he died, half of it.
I think Game of Death.
Is it Game of Death? I don't remember which one it is. And it's so crappy because like at one point they literally like cut his face from another film, like literal the film, and like glue it on.
Yeah, glue it on the frames.
On the frames, like for reaction shots. So hopefully Hunger Games is a little better than that.
What was that? The movie that was Dr. Parnassus right after Heath Ledger, and then they ended up, because he goes through like portals, they hired
the Terry
Jude Law, Johnny Depp, and Colin Farrell, I think.
That was an interesting fix.
Yeah, like that's like, I mean, but that, because it was like a weird movie that he's going through like different, you know, again.
Yeah, the story could justify the change.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So
that one, like, they kind of.
And that's our next podcast, movies that have happened, like, you know, post.
We're just gonna
pass away too early.
Well, Kyle,
I think there was one with Anton Yelchin.
No, he's never been CGI'd into a movie. Are you talking about CGI'd into a movie or just like released posthumously?
There was one. I didn't know if he was. I am saying like, yeah, post, you know, his death. But I know there was one that took a while to release, so I wasn't sure what they did with it. I'm not saying.
Well, Thoroughbreds is coming out around the time of this podcast releases, and he's in that, but I don't think there's no CGI goofery in there.
Yeah, I think that just took time to find just distribution.
Because I saw that 6 months ago, and I loved it, so it's when it comes out, go see that. Don't watch this, go see Thoroughbreds.
Hey, we want people to watch this film so they can listen to this podcast, but it's a chicken and egg thing. If they've listened this far, like an hour in, they've probably seen this film or just really have no lives,
right?
And like,
so you
gotta
cut that, what Joey said, no. And put it at the top of the show.
Yes. Exactly.
Hey man,
it's like, hey guys, go watch Thoroughbreds.
If you got the download, that's all I care about. You download the podcast. No, you download the podcast, hear us say, don't watch this movie, go watch Thoroughbreds, delete the podcast, they're gonna get the next one. We're giving them good advice. It's helpful. It's good advice.
I want people to watch this because it's one of his last roles.
And yeah, but there's better roles. Like, you don't need to watch this just because it's one of his last roles. Like, if Nicolas Cage died tomorrow, knock on wood, please do not die tomorrow. Like, we wouldn't say, go see Arsenal because it's one of his last roles. But like, no, go back and see, like, Honeymoon in Vegas or something. Like, there's a guy who has a career that spans decades. Like, don't go see shit just because he put it out toward the end. Go direct people to, like, you know, Along Came Polly or, like, an actual good movie. Like, whatever.
Yeah, I know, but I'm just saying in a career of, like, a guy that, you know, I think personally, like, pretty much gave it his all in every performance. You know, maybe this was a bland character, but I still think he did a good job. And so if you are a Philip Seymour Hoffman, I recommend watching this movie.
And just to be clear, this is an adaptation from a short story. There's no movie novelization of this I can go track down or anything like that to.
Well, there's no God's Pocket 3, Mike, so I don't know if this is necessarily up your wheelhouse anyway.
I guess that's something I'll never have to worry about.
Or will you?
You never know. All it takes is a 2. For there to be a 3.
Most of the time.
No, there also needs to be a 3. Like, there needs to be a 2 and then a 3. So
we're still waiting for the Ted 3.
There's a lot. Oh, so soon.
Where are you?
Soon.
I just have to say it because I feel like even just saying it is putting it out there in the ether to get it to happen.
Question, a technical question. If Bill and Ted 3 comes out, what show do you release the first episode on? Is it like a crossover show?
Oh, well, we would probably do it for Keanu Club, and then Mike could either use that on his show. Because, like, so here's a sneak peek. We have not announced this yet on anywhere, but this summer, for both the Charlize podcast and the Channing Tatum podcast, we're going to get to about the same month this movie called Battle in Seattle, I think. And we're going to do the same episode for both, and we're just going to play both shows' games for it and do different
giant
intros
crossover.
For each. Yeah. And then when we get to Fate of the Furious, we might do something similar. We're just going to do it separately. We're going to do that. Like, that's around the same time, but we're going to do it on our podcast. We're also going to do it on Watch the Throne, too. So,
yeah.
But Battle in Seattle is going to be a special occasion.
Interesting. That's...
Yeah, and I think eventually when I get to Tokyo Drift, I'll try and time it for the lap where Joey and Joe 2 are watching Tokyo Drift again.
Well, that's what I was going to say, because you're
cross that
on
over.
Too Fast, Too Forever, you're never spoiling theirs if you're on a different lap, you know? So that would be fun. I like crossover things. It's always good
synergy.
Michelle ends up on Family Matters or something.
Because that is the most obvious reference is the time, you know.
Well,
Urkel
also
and Michelle.
Speaking of Family Matters, is how Family Matters was a Perfect Strangers spinoff. So, I mean, that's the same
thing,
right?
Too. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, spinoffs.
Yeah, like, you know, and then spinoffs lead to spinoffs. There could be a whole podcast
Smart
on that.
Guy.
I'm sure there is. Smart Guy was not a spinoff of anything.
But the problem you run into there is you have to watch every episode of that TV show, and it's like, you know, I'd rather watch God's Pocket once a week for a year than watch every episode of all those shows just do a podcast for them.
Yeah, no, I mean, I don't know. I mean, every episode, that's tough.
Yeah, especially Family Matters.
I always thought
Perfect Strangers, I think I would do that without, you know, you wouldn't have to pay me, but...
Wow.
I don't know about Urkel. I don't know how far I could take that.
I'm sure there's a podcast of this, but I've always wanted there to be, like, a podcast on, like, pilots. Just like you watch pilots of different shows.
Good.
Clearly,
nice concept.
Clearly, God's Pocket was not a very exciting movie because we've devolved into just something else entirely. But
those are some of the best shows. Some of the best shows are that they stray, you know, off topic.
Very true.
It's just it took us to the end of the show to do it.
Unfortunately,
we should have.
So, what have you guys been up to lately? Anything interesting?
Yeah, plug away, guys, shamelessly.
Well, Too Fast, Too Forever now has a Facebook page, so go check that out, facebook.com/too fast.
I saw that, I liked it.
Because Mike created a Facebook page for his show, and we're like, hey, because here's the thing about Facebook. It's like, if we had a Zac Efron, Zac Attack Facebook page, now it would just be like a Zac Efron fan page, or it would just be like a dead page. And so either way, it's not good. But the way that we saw it, like the same thing with like Mike's podcast and also with mine, or with Too Fast, Too Forever, those shows theoretically can last forever. So there might as well be a place just for those. I mean, we're still going to have everything over at the Cage Club Facebook, but We're going to get a little bit weirder over on the Too Fast, Too Forever page, I think, just because that's what that show's all about.
Yeah, no, I'm excited. You have more opportunity for that there. More, some more debates going on. Private Fast and Furious debates. I'm always going to be on the side of Suki. That's just me. But
well, I can't wait to see like the fan base that gets drawn in. That, you know, from car culture, Furious fan base, like the whole, you know, thing is going to like see this new Facebook page pop up, and then we're just going to get all these like draw all these new listeners, and then they're going to discover the other shows. So
and then
I'm looking at it as like a leeway.
And then they're going to be confused as fuck when we eventually go to a weekly show and then alternate the Fast and Furious movies with whatever other movies or TV shows we want to talk about. They're like, hey, there's this really cool Fast and Furious podcast, but this week they talked about Spring Breakers. Like, okay, that's sure, why not? So that's going
to
be fun too.
You need to go to the Fast and Furious live like.
Oh no, we're planning on that. Do not worry about that.
Oh, I can't wait for that one.
That's got to be coming to like Nassau Coliseum or something like that.
Joey, have you ever tricked out a hot import?
No, but my friends were saying, imagine if instead of watching movies, you just learned how to like fix cars. And I was like, oh, it's kind of a cool idea, I guess. But, you know, I have not ever tricked out a hot import, but maybe one day I will. Spoiler alert, I will not.
Oh man!
Well, for boyfriend material, your main man on that learned how to build a car and built his own car for drive. So there you go.
Oh wow!
Well, Keanu builds his own motorcycle in real life too. So I mean, we got a lot of handy men around this podcast network.
Yeah, it's kind of like a car motorcycle, like a man's podcast network, like a real.
Well, I mean, you know, red sports cars are predominant in Cage Club. Yes, so, you know.
Yeah, like bros chilling and stuff.
But yeah, so gearheads.
So this episode comes out, what, mid-March-ish?
Sure, yeah.
So in the last month or so, to get back to plugging things, we had the Contenders begin, which is every other Tuesday. So that is Tobin and Island Addington go through and shine a light on the unruly women of cinema. So it's movies that are either directed by or starring women. So I was on episode 2, Wonder Woman. Mike will be on an episode coming up shortly. We also had launch on the 21st of February, Winona Forever, a bi-weekly Winona Ryder podcast. Mike's show launched a couple weeks ago, Third Time's a Charm. And then we also have two other new shows that I don't want to say by name launching this month. One that we've teased for a long time that I hope happens. And the other one, which is actually kind of cool, surprising news. I just don't want to say anything just in case, you know, timing changes or whatever. But yeah, in the last, like, you know, month or so, we've had basically 5 new shows add. So things are trucking, to use another car term.
Sweet. I mean, again, Cage Club Podcast Network is becoming just like the hub of everything. It's like the black hole of pop culture, just things getting sucked in and warped out the other side.
I don't think that's how black holes work, but I appreciate the analogy.
You know what? If you guys had a podcast on how black holes work, I would learn. But if it's not on a podcast, I don't know.
Yeah, and also, I'll just say, like, this month, March, Third Time's a Charm, Joey's on that episode, and it's Superman 3. So if you want...
The best Superman movie.
Yeah, and if you want to go on eBay or Amazon and get the book, the novelization that I read parts of on the show, it's extremely cheap. And next month is Jaws 3D. The third dimension is terror. So I just wanted to throw that out there.
Oh, I love it. Can't wait. Kyle, anything else? Anything you want to plug personally in your life?
No, I'm good right now. Maybe in the future. Maybe by the end of this podcast.
All right. Well, thanks so much, guys, for coming on.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you for the second time coming on together. Something I learned.
Go back and watch The Devil Knows You're Dead. So you know,
I honestly, like, I could have...
Kyle, is this fair to say that while you do produce and edit and, you know, obviously a very valuable member of PS I Love Hoffman, you're not necessarily a fan of our podcast?
Yes, there you go. That's perfect. Sure.
Anyway, thanks so much, guys. I don't know which one of you today wants to close us out, but you can decide amongst
yourselves.
Joey
said he was going to defer, I think, last time he was on for Moneyball.
So I had to do it for Moneyball. I'm never doing it again.
That's fine. We don't want you to. Mike, could you remind people to stay uncool?
Stay uncool, everybody.
Thank you, Michael Manzi.
Thank you.
And welcome. Thank you, Joey.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you.